Welcome to Listening Station by Feral Practice. This podcast brings together all 7 episodes and is approximately 50 minutes long. In the first episode, Jean Jefferies talks on the phone to Feral Practice about her memories of family life in the station master's house at Mangotsfield.
I was 12. And my sister was 8. And we moved there from Somerset on the day that the Queen was married.
Wow. And what was that like when you arrived?
The house had been occupied, of course, ever since the station had opened, but it was still, in some ways, primitive. There was no electricity. We had gas lights. And all the conveniences were sadly very primitive.
Oh dear.
My mother worked very hard to get electricity brought and the telephone brought and a modicum of convenience and modernity. Mangotsfield was very busy. It was a busy junction. I mean, every night there was the biggest and longest goods train that I have ever seen, which disgorged all its contents at about between 9:30 and 10:30 at night. And the contents of the train were all piled up on the platform and thereafter taken away and dispersed by road. In the summer holidays, one of our great things was to help with the parcel train, and we were allowed to stay up. We weren't at any other time of the year, of course, but we were allowed to stay up and help with the parcels. We also particularly liked the mail train at night, and you could post your letters on that train with an extra halfpenny on the postage. There were numerous sorters, sorting mail, and carrying that mail up to the north of England.
So the train was actually like a post office, like a sorting office?
A travelling post office, yes.
Amazing.
And that was quite exciting. It, of course, had its shortcomings. My father was always quite worried about the living somewhere where you had to cross the main line, north and south, north and west, and the dangers that trains approaching from Gloucester came down and round the curve very, very speedily. Mm. As children, we were constantly reminded of how dangerous it could be.
And was that the final place that your father worked, or did he move on when the station closed?
He went on to be the assistant district operating superintendent at Bath Green Park. But we stayed on in the house because it was not required, because already by then the alterations and the beaching plan and so on were beginning to gain momentum.
Mm. Must have been a sad time.
It was, in a way. And then, of course, the house caught fire. I married, and our married home was about 5 miles away. And it was the night during the Falklands War when one of our important ships went down. And I was listening to that on the radio when a friend from Mangotsfield rang me, who is a in the police force, he was the inspector, phoned me to tell me that Station House was on fire.
Oh, gosh.
And my mother was on holiday in the Channel Islands. And she came back to having lost absolutely everything.
Oh, how awful.
The house had been broken into. Before they left, they had fired it. The fire had broken through the roof by the time we got there, and there was really nothing that could be done. So she returned from her holiday to find that she had just the suitcase that she'd taken with her. It was a strange place to live in that you were living in a triangle. At night, you could hear rumbling most of the night. It was a strange dwelling because it was literally built against the wall of the station. You had this amazing high stone wall with almost ecclesiastical type windows all along its length, except that they weren't windows because Station House was literally built against them and they had coloured glass in them. And of course it was quite a sheltered garden because you had another of these very high walls and these windows on the bath line. You could grow more or less anything there. My parents had always, they were country people, and they'd always been quite keen gardeners, particularly my mother. It was quite an extensive setup, and with the Brunel design station, people could come and be dry and comfortable and meet people in comparative comfort. Of course, it was a haven for train spotters. Plenty of lads taking train numbers. My husband was, I don't know whether he ever took train numbers, but he did, he said. Was one of them.
So he married the right girl.
Well, we've been married for 61 years, so...
In this episode, local people talk about childhood adventures. In order of appearance, you will hear Jamie, Amber and her parents, and students and staff from Culverhill School in Yate.
If you catch them right in nature, they change. They like actually most people do, but it's really noticeable with kids.
Well, I've been coming here since I was, since I was born almost. Was it Mum?
Yeah. They used to come up here quite often with their nanny. It was quite a fun place because, like, when she picked them up from school, when they was, like, you know, wee dappers in primary school, you know, she always used to come, she used to walk them down here, come in the station and then walk them down, because we live on Middle Road.
Okay.
Which is just down by Cook's. We live down there. So it was a round robin. It was always get them out. Nanny was always a very positive person about, you know, getting in the fresh air.
Yeah.
Let kids be kids.
Yeah. And we used to come and play games and used to build dens in the trees. Aww. So, like, that tree, the tall one there and the tall one in the corner, like, we always used to come and climb on them and, like, play in and out the windows and, like, play pretend games and stuff. Like, this used to be a castle. I'd, like, sit there and, like, play Rapunzel out the window and that kind of thing. Like, it was just all kind of the old brickwork and stuff, because I didn't realise, obviously, it was a cycle track and stuff. When I was younger, I just used to thought it was this secret place that would, like, only my nan knew about. So we used to, like, have this all to ourselves. And then when other children used to come and play, we used to be like, oh, like, what are you doing here? Like, how did you know this was here? So have you ever heard of the film The Secret Garden?
Mm.
That was, like, I watched that film as a kid, and this was my secret garden.
Yeah.
This was, like, a secret place we could come into and kind of hide and climb trees and build dens. Like, it was me and my brother and my nan used to collect, like, all the different types of leaves and stuff, because she was a gardener, so she knew a lot about the plants and things.
Mm.
And same with so my nan was on my dad's side, and then my granddad on my mum's side used to teach us about, like, types of trees and things. We used to come up and spot, like, which different types of trees, like, oh, that's an oak and that's an ash and all that kind of stuff, and then, like, take leaves back and make, like, little art projects out of them.
Nice.
In urban situations, it's harder to get people to just disengage from their technology.
Because we're so in our heads,
that's
aren't
right.
we?
That's right.
And the screens keep us in our heads.
That's right. Yeah. I always think that, you know, in terms of well-being, and that's, if you can align that where you're in the moment, and your thoughts are not anywhere else, there's less thinking, just doing, it does make a difference. You do feel better after, you know. Just think about my son this morning. You know, he's just so moody, and because, you know, sort of, come on, do this, do that, got to get ready, da, da, da. But then I think about him on half term when he was in the water and on the beach and with a couple of friends. He's just so happy. And that had nothing to do with all the things that he says that he wants when he's in the city.
Expedition.
Oh, you're on an expedition.
We
yes.
are. Well, from we're from Colby Hill School in the 8. These are year 10 and 11 pupils.
Hello.
Hi. And we have been.
Why don't you show the lady your map that we're using?
What we do is we just follow it, really. It just tells us what we need to do and we just do it.
Excellent. So you've got a plan.
So we're using a compass. We're using what we're using. What are these things called?
Maps.
No, what are they called?
Instructions.
They are instructions, yeah, but they're pictures, aren't they? They're picture instructions for us.
So you've got a series of photographs there.
Yes. There's up the app.
And it's got waymarkers, landmarks, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's great. And we were told earlier on, because we met here for lunch, we've done a bit of a loop, that what we were sat, this is the old waiting room, and the waiting room of the old station.
That's right. Have you been enjoying it today?
Oh, it's been awesome. Yeah.
What is that?
Amazing.
What have your highlights been? What's your favourite?
What's
been
your favourite part of the journey?
Gold days.
Yeah.
Sure.
Mangot filled station too.
Oh no, my favourite bit. Lunch.
Did you have
fries? And a wrap, crisp bit of fruit. You've got to be healthy.
Yeah, excellent.
So start coming up here when I was younger, and then I used to come up here with my friends in like secondary school and stuff. And we used to just come and hang out here. It was just more like just down the road. It's obviously all like the hubbub and hurry of the houses and kind of shops and things like that. And then you come here, it's like a little oasis of just green.
It's just something about being surrounded by trees and plants, I think, isn't there?
Completely. And we'd meet here and then we'd climb up, probably quite dangerous, but we'd climb up that massive hill there, like up all the trees and roots, but we would always meet in here as like a kind of gathering point. And then they'd always walk back down to here. And then we'd say goodbye, and then I'd walk back down that way, and they'd go that way. Yeah.
Nice.
It's quite interesting to me what you're saying about almost thinking long-term about the kind of experiences that you're laying down for your children and what they might mean to them as they accrue.
Yeah, I think that's a really tough one for parents to do, to think in advance, because a lot of the time, you know, rightly or wrongly, you're kind of accommodating parenthood with whatever else you envisaged for yourself, and so it becomes quite a reactive practice, whereas if you could stop, pause and actually put some time into it, if I could plot it properly and really get myself thinking about family life as a number one project, then I would be like, well, okay, this bit of money that I've got here, or I'm gonna, what can I do so that every so often, you know, they get that type of amazing experience that they'll always remember.
Having her pass away, this is such a strong memory point. Like, certain things that make me remember her, and this is one of the places that I have the strongest memories of being with her and being around her, and like having such happy memories, and it's all kind of in this place. So whenever I come back, I will always think of my nan.
She's here for you.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. That was just well.
That's lovely.
Just to
no. That's
have a little memory
story.
And
thank
share
you.
That with other people. Cool.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
Right then, troop. Should we start heading on again? Had a little breather.
Yeah.
You want a drink? Sienna had a drink.
Let's go home and watch some television.
No, well that's it. There's
not
going to be any television tonight, is there?
No, you're singing around a campfire.
Yeah, I've got
lots
of firewood.
Ginga
Gooley.
Ginga Gooley and
s'mores.
Thank you
very
much. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
Have fun tonight.
What? Da-da-da.
In this episode, Bernard and Sue talk about old times, and local scientist and glowworm enthusiast Stephen Parkinson talks about cold light and warm nights.
Obviously, when we were children, you knew where to look, and it was part of being a child, you know, looking for them, if you know what I mean, but...
Yeah. I couldn't believe I'd seen one. I'd heard about them, but not really paid attention to them.
We had them at home, didn't we, when we moved in?
Yeah, we did, when we moved in, yeah. But
we had them in the garden.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was in Kingswood, not far from here.
Yeah. That was 50-odd years ago, like, do you know what I mean? So
yeah, yeah, yeah.
We haven't seen them in later years, have we? No. Not seen them at all.
Have you ever seen glowworms?
Ah, we've seen things. Yeah. Oh, well, no, I've never seen a glowworm.
I was on my way back from a gig in Bath. Forget who I'd seen on a Saturday night 20 years ago, but I was cycling back on a very warm July night. As I got near Salford, I saw what seemed to be a light on the path. It was bright green, like an LED, and I thought somebody's dropped this off their bike. So I slowed down and I had a look, and I couldn't believe what I saw. It was a big fat beetle, and the last three segments of her abdomen were glowing this brilliant LED green, and I was just entranced, and my first instinct was to look in my rucksack and see if I could find a container, because I felt I had to show this to all my colleagues at the Science Centre. The day later I met up with my colleagues, and in the pub we sat in a dark corner, and I opened up this little bottle, and there she was, glowing away. And we were all simultaneously in trance. I very quickly found my way to the UK Glowworm Survey, which is a blog site, a website put together by Robin Skagill, who lives in Gloucestershire. And I felt compelled to become part of the UK Glowworm Survey. And so every year, in the first 2 weeks of July, I cycle up and down the cycle path from here to Bath and look for glowworms and report them. Over the years, there's been a fairly persistent colony down by Salford and Bitton, and I used to see them here in Mangotsfield Station, and I used to bring my daughter and her friends along. I remember taking her out when she was five, and I had a seat on the back, because we had to cover quite a long way. The very first night we went out and found some, it was one of those lovely, warm July nights, and we cycled at great speed all the way down to Salford and then back again, and we found three, and I've got photographs of her holding this thing, and she had a Dennis the Menace red and black stripy jumper and a bright green thing, and yeah, she was in trance. And you find these glowworms either on the side of the cycle path in the short grass, or in the long grass, or sometimes in hedges, but they do like to advertise their presence, and they do tend to they climb up high so you can see them, and they will advertise to males, but as soon as they've mated, that's it, they'll turn off. The balance is a knife edge. On one side, you've got the attractiveness of finding a mate, and on the downside, you've got the fact that you're advertising your presence to anything that can eat you. If she does mate, she'll lay eggs, and then the whole three-year cycle will start again. The larvae will stay in the same place, grubbing around on the floor, and until 3 years later, in their final molt, they will start glowing brightly. And it's exquisite. And nature has hit upon the same two chemicals at the bottom of the sea, in fireflies and in glowworms, luciferin and luciferase. And these are the two chemicals that, when they meet together, they give off this beautiful, cold green light. And funny enough, we use luciferin in DNA analysis and DNA modification, because it's a marker. In Australia, to combat truck drivers driving off the sides of these long straight roads in the desert, they were going to insert these glowing DNA instructions into tobacco plants and plant them along the side of the highway.
Okay.
So they were like glowing markers.
Been quite spooky, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And the glowworms are living on the edge of survivability, and over the years they declined, and I haven't seen any there now for the last over 10 years. And a couple of years ago, they installed some wildlife-friendly lighting on the cycle path. But I was very dismayed when, come the first 2 weeks of July, when the glowworms are active, the lights stayed on. So quite clearly, nobody had told the people organising the wildlife-friendly lights when they should turn off. So I think that was the final death knell. And if you turn off the lights at night, not only can you save a lot of money, you can also have proper dark skies and start to see the Milky Way and other exciting treasures. Every year, I learn again how magical nature is. It's always a joy to see the first glowworm.
This episode brings audio recorded at Meet the Insects, a listening station event with Nick Hudson of Wild Pace, together with snippets from Feral Practice talking to botanist David Hawkins as they get excited about the insects they're finding at Mangotsfield Station.
So you can draw the little snail later on. Oh, look at that. Wow, everybody can look through that.
So we got all sorts of bugs. We've got little ones with lots of legs. How many does... There's a spider. Does anybody know how many legs a spider has?
Eight.
You're so clever, you lot. Parents, yeah, any guesses?
That's a nymph of one of the bugs.
So that looks sort of almost aqua.
Yeah.
Coloured.
That's exactly it.
Don't get in there.
You know, you were asking about the nymphs of the tortoise bug, for example, and how small they are. There's one.
Oh, crikey.
It's tiny, isn't it?
Would you know what that is? It's barely more than a dot.
That's really cute.
Oh, hello. Really. It's actually quite stripy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a cute little thing, isn't it?
So
that's going to become...
Almost completely circular.
Yeah, it's going to become that lovely bug. Try and find that ladybird. It's somewhere in the mix here. There's a little tiny weevil there with a very long nose.
This one.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
That's so cartoon.
Yeah.
Isn't it? With that crazy nose.
Yeah. Really, really long snout. Ah, that bishop's mitre. Ooh, that's an interesting weevil. That's a very different sort of weevil. That's got its snout is folded right over, curved right over. Very different. So it's kind of, instead of being like that, it's like that.
Elephant.
Yeah, exactly. Very cool. Ah, there's the ladybird, right. Okay. There it is. Oh, very lovely little things, these. 24 spot ladybird.
And is that the normal size for it?
Yeah, they are small.
Teeny.
Yeah, they are quite small.
I don't think I've ever seen one of those before.
And it eats grass. And what a charming little thing.
Yeah, it is very cute.
And
so it's sort of, like you say, it's more terracotta, isn't it, than bright red.
That's it, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pleasing, isn't it?
Cool.
Yeah. I'll put that on my list quickly. I just stopped because there's a bee here that's hanging out on this patch, and then...
Is that another of those ladybirds? No, a different one.
Oh, nice. Oh, a seven spot. Classic seven spot. So there's some bee nests here.
Oh, yeah.
There's one there, and they do like the bare ground.
Would you be able to hazard a guess what kind of bee would live in that hole?
There's quite a number that could be living in that hole. Yeah, well, there's an ant's nest there. Actually, maybe that's an ant's nest exit, not a bee hole. I wonder.
Possibly.
It does look quite bee-esque. Anyway, sorry, you wanted to go outside the wall, so I think that's a cool
it's
idea.
Kind of got more interesting. So there's quite a few geraniums. We've got Herb Robert here as well.
We have, yeah. And we've got
hedge wound dwarf.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favourites. I love that stuff.
It's one of my favourites as well.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. Oh, I love it. And
it's a beauty.
It is stunning. And yeah, the bees go mad for it. And there's some quite cool bugs that turn up on it as well sometimes. But, Oh, there's a spooky fly there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting fly.
Oh, it looks like a skull.
Yes, it's like a terrifying little little thing. I'm going to just see if I can catch it because it's Sicus ferrugineus. I know what it's called just because it's a fly you see a lot. It's quite sinister looking, isn't it?
It's quite sinister. It does look, there's something about it. It's got really big dark eyes.
Yeah.
And a pale head, which makes it look like a skull.
Mm, yeah, it does.
It's got kind of very pointy mouth parts that are strange.
It's doubly sinister because it parasitizes bumblebees. So it's waiting around here, is what it always does, to lay an egg. It will pounce on a bumblebee and then lay an egg on it.
Oh, really?
And yeah. And then the larvae consumes the bee.
That's definitely not friendly.
Yeah, it's pretty intense.
Oh, there's a snail on the stone, you're right, Marina.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry,
okay. Well done.
Yeah, so that's a banded snail. Can you put it in that?
Oh my gosh.
Do you want to put it in this tub, my love? There we go. Well done. He'll pop his head out soon.
Can I just
say hello?
Look at that.
Isn't that gorgeous?
So what's that? And it's a snail blowing a trumpet.
Friend.
What noise does it make?
A sort of.
Yes.
I will hold it.
Right.
Beetles.
No, but we found.
Daddy, why didn't you put it back in the?
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Can I have a look?
Right.
Does it have a particular name?
This one is Samantha. So Ruby's not.
Don't want to put it all up, really.
There's quite a lot of low down. There's these sort of cuckoo spit type things. Is that cuckoo spit or is that something else?
It is cuckoo spit. It's, that's the larvae of the common froghopper.
So why does it do, what does it do and why does it do that?
That is the larva of the common froghopper, which is a very ubiquitous, charming bug. And the adult comes in many colour forms, so it's quite confusing. In fact, just this morning I saw one that looked absolutely fantastic. It looked like it was wearing houndstooth or something. Never seen that colour form before.
Yeah.
And yeah, of course, initially I thought, oh wow, what's this? You know, new bug. And it was a common froghopper, which is fine.
So it's just one species, but it's like they're a bit glamorous and they like changing their clothes a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And they are one species, but they are in a very large group of species which are very overlooked and not given the attention they deserve.
The froghoppers.
Yeah, the froghoppers and the plant hoppers in general.
Because they're so tiny though, aren't they?
They are really small. In fact, this is one of the largest.
Is it?
Relatively speaking. Well, yeah, it is pretty big. By the standards of froghoppers and plant hoppers and leaf hoppers. And the larvae drink the sap of many plants, actually. They're quite cosmopolitan in terms of what they consume. And then they excrete this lovely foam, like you get in a posh restaurant, you know, when you get some kind of truffle foam or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And they excrete the foam and then they sort of live in the foam. And sort of,
and that protects them.
Yeah, they kind of swim about in it. I think when they pupate, when they're ready to move on to being an adult, I think the foam kind of hardens into this little case, and then they just chill out in there and get dressed. Yeah, yeah, they are really good, aren't they?
I like the idea of them as having a changing room.
You
got there.
Oh, I got loads.
You got the
it.
Lots in there.
Yeah.
Beautiful peacock.
There's a red spider in here.
Oh, really? Can't see. Oh, yeah, I see on the side.
Yeah, and I think I have a little bit of ink on me.
That's amazing, isn't it? It's so bright colour.
I was trying to find Nick.
He's coming back in a sec. He's just gone to get a pot.
I just need to find him.
Poor Nick.
Go and find him. Bring him home.
In this episode, you will hear audio recorded at Meetings with Birds, a listening station event with ornithologist Aurora Gonzalez Tirodo, and snippets from Feral Practice chatting about birds with local walker Alexander.
Red
I can't believe it's so loud.
And it's big.
Yeah, they're tiny little snails.
I've heard it.
They're probably the loudest, I think. I don't know, but they're probably
they're
sort of fighting now. See if one sings and then the other replies.
Are they quite feisty with each other? I mean, like robins.
I think they're less territorial than robins.
Yeah.
But they keep singing. See, that's sort of a fight between them.
Oh.
See the other one replies.
What do you imagine that they are saying
to
each other?
Nasty things.
Oh really?
Get away! Yeah. This is my territory.
That's good.
Yeah, I mean, I was just sat feeding a crow. That was next. We ended up calling him Kevin. So just earlier, I was just throwing him bits. I was like, I'm not gonna eat all this. Here you go. And he was just kind of there, just like shoving it all in his mouth and then kind of waddling away.
I love the way they walk. Sometimes they look really geezerish, don't they?
And it's like, oi, give me your bread. And it's like, I'm sorry, take the bread. So I just don't. And then I had a magpie sit above me as well. I was like, oh, it's all going on. They all know I have food now.
Yeah.
So,
have you seen the woodpecker hole around the corner?
No, I haven't. So, I have not seen that yet.
Do you want to see it?
Absolutely.
It's so smooth on the inside. It's amazing, and it's kind of like head height, so you can really look in it.
I've never seen it.
But here. Oh wow! Sorry, just showing a woodpecker hole. Look at that.
I've never seen a woodpecker hole before. I couldn't imagine doing that with my head. No. And I'm not designed to do it, but this looks
an interesting hole because it just goes straight in and stops. So a woodpecker wouldn't have nested in there.
No, it's too small.
But so why is it so big and neat?
Because a woodpecker is bigger and it was trying to find something to eat or hiding or whatever, and then it creates this feature that is ideal for the birds for nesting. It's got this one. A little bit smaller starting, and then another one in there.
This snapped off.
That's ideal. See all the holes in there? It's because there were larvae or insects in there, so they were trying to find them.
So how does it, if they actually nest in a hole, how does it change?
A woodpecker. And it will be much deeper. So if the hole is here, it will go like maybe two arms down. And then the chicks will be deep in the tree.
Should squirrels eat mango? Just want some mango? I got some mango. just like, I don't know whether to feed you this mango or not. I don't know if it'll make you sick.
I've seen squirrels eat apples.
Yeah, I feel like they could eat apples.
Foxes eat a lot of fruit.
I didn't know that.
You looking at animal poo to see who's been around and what they've been up to. All the poo goes purple in the autumn when they're eating blackberries and stuff.
I didn't know that.
But it goes around like a normal ring. So this is an interesting bird because some of you were here before when I was telling you about the breeding condition and the way to sex some of the birds. The females will lose the feathers in the belly in order to provide heat to the eggs. If you look at this belly, can you see that?
Yeah.
All bare and thick. It's because she recently had babies. So we know it's a female. The age on these guys are a little bit more difficult because what we're looking for is a contrast in different coloration in the feathers in order to know if they have molted some of the feathers or just them all. And we have two ways to age wrens, and it's like, if we look at the fourth primary, this is the first, the second, the third, and the fourth, and we count the dots, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. If they got less than 9, it means that that feather is a juvenile feather. She still has the feathers from the nest from last year.
Right.
Because also we can look at the state of those feathers. And they are really worn and broken.
Mm.
See that?
Yeah.
That's because she's been having those feathers for a year.
Yeah.
She will mold these feathers.
This is my sort of go-to quiet space.
Is it?
So I just talking to someone, one of my friends at WhatsApp, like, oh, what are you up to? I said, well, I'm currently sat in a tree in a field. And she's like, in a tree? I was like, yes. And he's like, that's a bit weird, I said.
It shouldn't be.
I was like, I'm very relaxed right now. So I've got 2 days off, so I was just like, relax. Because work's been busy.
Yeah.
So.
Do you have a favourite tree that you sit in?
I think it's like one of the gents in here down there with their bicycles, so I haven't sat in it. Well, it's just very peaceful. And then you just can't help yourself when you're cycling along, you kind of come up onto the station platform and then you go back down to the park
again. It invites you to stop. When you say you're sitting, do you have a particular practice or is it just letting your thoughts...
It's just letting myself wander, really.
And you don't go onto your screens?
Not really, no. I try to avoid it. I may have a piece of music in my ear, but it's just sort of... And then one ear is kind of open, listening to whatever. Sometimes I'll just kind of sit and just kind of go...
Let me give it to you. So I'll put your fingers in there.
My left hand, yeah?
Yeah. Feel the neck. You're feeling the neck?
Yes.
You don't need to hold the legs.
Yes.
Just like that. And then whenever you are ready, open that.
Yes.
And it will hopefully go. Bye. It's
sorry.
Gone.
Did you catch that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. Thank you.
Great action shot. Oh.
In this episode, Jeff, Doug and Terry, three members of the Mangotsfield Railway Circle, reminisce about the station and their adventures.
Because we had no money as kids, we would go there all night and watch the trains go up and down, because this was a famous junction for Bath. And thanks, Doug. And the... For example, the Newcastle train would come down, pull in here, and over here would be the Bath train waiting to take people who wanted to go to Bath. But if ever they let the Bath train go, you would have people stranded on this station.
For how long?
Well, there's the famous story about the guy from Dad's Army, who wrote the book. What was it called? The Ghost?
Ghost Train.
The Ghost Train. The Ghost Train.
Do you ever watch Dad's Army?
I do.
Remember the old...
The old guy.
What was his name?
Godfrey.
Yeah, he wrote that based on a night here when the mist came down over the common and it was all eerie, and he got the inspiration for writing Ghost Train.
So, it's a fact.
Quite a while.
So, yes. Yeah.
So this was a busy station.
Yeah. This was such a big station, there was no bridge, platform to platform, there's an underpass.
Where is that?
You can see the arch of the... You can see the arch along here somewhere. There's the arch there, look.
Oh, yeah.
See this arch on there, across here, to that platform there. Ah. And it was quite busy on a morning because there's a chocolate factory over there called Carson's. Not there now, of course. And that was not market on a par with Thornton's. It was good quality chocolate.
All right.
And people used to come here, get off and go to the factory over there.
Yeah.
It was a massive building because you could stand up on the common there. If you shouted out loud, your voice would come back.
You couldn't see any houses, there was nothing around at all in those days. There was just Carson's factory, the station master's house, and that was it. That was it. It was all dark and gloomy, and it was lovely. But with the gas lights, it was romantic anyway, if you like. It was not dimly lit, and it was incredible.
Yeah.
It was a busy station.
We used to tease the railway staff, the station staff, fall out with them now and then, but whenever they were busy, we'd help them load the parcels.
We're members of an organisation, MRC, which is Mangotsfield Railway Circle.
How are you?
It was a beautiful station. It was completely covered. It's not like a little village station. It was incredible. And these trees were planted to coincide with the steel struts that held the roof up.
But the whole of that built, all that wall along there and then across and then a wall down the other side over here, that was all like offices and ticket office.
Ladies,
and,
There was always a fire in the ladies.
Porter's room.
There was always a fire in the ladies. Waiting room, weren't there, the winter? Yeah. Nothing in the gents, but.
Another feature was the pigeon train from the north.
Yes,
used to come here.
The pigeon train?
Pigeons.
Absolutely full of pigeons, homing pigeons.
Uh-huh.
And this would be what? Something like probably 10 carriages long?
Yeah.
They used to go along the back of that, the other platform that was the other side of there, and go into the sidings there. And then all the porters and volunteers and people used to get all ready. And then at a certain time, they would all try and put all these shutters down. And you'd see all this great crowd of pigeons. They would fly up in the air, get in a bunch, circle around once, and off they'd go.
Yeah,
it's quite a sight.
How amazing.
Yeah.
And that was a regular thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Every Saturday morning.
Just during the sort of springtime and into summer. Which was a big thing up north, but it was down here as well, wasn't it, to a certain degree, but not as big as
up north.
Up north, but it would have probably 10 or a dozen porters on it one time.
Mm.
and, you know, yeah, people to...
To feed them on their journey and that sort of thing, you see. Another, sad to say, but we were train spotters, you see. So we're always glad to see that particular train, because it came from... most of the trains through here would go to the Birmingham, Derby, Newcastle, Bradford, and that side of... You wouldn't have a train come from here to Manchester or Liverpool. But the pigeon trains would come from Blackpool, Preston, Liverpool. Yeah. So there'd be a rare engine on it. So we were always pleased to... We'd always be an engine we hadn't seen before. Whereas all the ones up and down here all the time, Bristol's Newcastle and that, they were engines that were shedded in Bristol, so we'd see them regularly.
Sure. Mm. So when you say it's an engine that you don't see normally, is that a type of engine or a specific actual...
Individual, because in like nowadays you have a string of carriages, and that's your train. Okay, back in the old days you had your carriages with an engine on the front.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's unique compared with now.
Gotcha. Mm. So did you ever catch a train here to go somewhere exciting?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes. Umpteen times. We used to get very very cheap tickets, something like 6 and 3 pence in old money. Return to Blackpool. We had one journey, there was about 20 of us, and we had to change trains at Birmingham. Well, we changed trains, about 19 of us, but one got left on the train, and he woke up, this is an old friend of ours who's passed on now, he woke up in sidings.
Oh dear.
Okay, and when we got here, back here on the Sunday morning, it was about 6 o'clock, and 18 of us got off, and the other one woke up in Bridgewater. So
you lost one on the way up, and one on the way back.
Both on the way back. Oh, yeah. So
your homing pigeon Croatian wasn't quite 100%.
No, exactly.
In this episode, Bristol entomologist Ray Barnett talks moths and more with feral practice at Mangotsfield, and includes a few highlights from the Bristol Moth Group meeting they'd both attended the previous night.
It's a red underwing. Oh no, is it?
That's a dark.
No. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, good lord.
That's a lifer for me.
What's this tall for? What's this tall tricks here?
What do you know?
That's Coralline.
New for me.
There's going to be a big spreadsheet.
So what you see in the end is a beautiful thing with red.
Good, good. Thank you.
It's gone under there, there it is in the corner.
Oh, yeah, sticking around.
Red underwing of duck. Crimson underwing.
Oh, and it's out.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, I was like, that one in the day, but I took some photographs, but I realised you've got a pet in the
So what makes it the dark crimson one? What's the...
They are actually remarkably difficult to separate, I think. I mean, pale tends to have a sort of a broader pale band across it with a more obvious pale spot on the forewing. There's a difference in the hindwing markings, aren't there? On the near edge of
I think so.
It's on your left leg.
There it is.
I think it's quite an exciting group of moth trackers, but you wouldn't really realise it, would you?
I don't know.
Yeah. No swearing as well. You're still recording, eh?
Yeah. I've worked at Bristol Museum and Art Gallery since 1989. Throughout that whole time, I've continued to pursue my own particular interests in natural history, and especially in insects entomology. And so that's 33 years of living in one place and having a chance to look at and to start to understand what's happening in the environment a bit more. When I first came here, there was a day-flying moth called the Scarlet Tiger, which was unheard of around here. And then suddenly that moth started to appear around Bristol. And it's a day-flying moth. It's bright scarlet, and it flies on sunny days in the summer. And we started to see reports of it, and we started to find them ourselves around the city. And since then, it's become really well established. And there's a related moth called the Jersey tiger moth, which also flies in the daytime, and is more yellow than orange, but again, it's a warning coloration. Now, the Jersey tiger moth is a really interesting species because it's actually a Mediterranean moth originally. And if you've ever been to Rhodes, the island of Rhodes in the Mediterranean, they have a place called the Valley of the Butterflies in the middle of the island, where it's actually very shady and cool. And in the middle of the summer, these moths, it's called the Valley of the Butterflies, but it's the Jersey tiger, they congregate there in hundreds and thousands of them. Somehow, some got translocated into Devon around the Torquay area in the 19th century. And that little population has managed to survive there because it's so mild in that part of the UK. And then in around the early to mid 2000s, that started to expand its population. And it reached the Bristol region in around 2008, 2009, and now is really common. This year, people have been seeing maybe 30 in one day around Bristol. We take great pleasure in telling people that butterflies are just a small group of day-flying moths in reality.
Ah, yes, there's more day-flying moths than butterflies, aren't there?
There are, yeah, it is true. Yeah.
Okay.
People say that moths have furry antennae.
Large bat.
And that the way they hold their wings, butterflies, hold them closed over their back, and moths tend to have them flat, that sort of thing. There are exceptions to all those rules. So there's 2,600 types of butterfly moth in the country. Mm-hmm. About 60 of them are butterflies. And they are just a group of moths that have become specialised to fly in the day, basically.
Okay.
Which we, recognize. Through cultural history, call butterflies.
Yeah.
Yeah. What we've been monitoring in the last 30 years, and that's been shown not only to be around Bristol, it's been also been shown to be across the whole country, is that many of our native species of moth have declined by about 40% in abundance over that period of time. Cuckoos, most Bristolians growing up today will have never heard a cuckoo. They've declined hugely over England. We have to make sure the whole environment is protected if you're going to keep them. And where they still occur is correlated with where you still get the species of moth that have big, hairy caterpillars, and that's their favourite food. And there's a complication here of what's actually affecting populations. There's a combination of climate change, but also where we see loss of abundance of native species. We think that's probably as much to do with the pesticide use in agriculture, the intensive agricultural activity that takes place today. In effect, most farms are using factory-type approaches to create homogeneous crops with very few weed species in them. Therefore, there's very little for insects to feed on. And it's a question of having lost many of the caterpillar food plants. You know, moths are big pollinators of plants as well, like many other insects. So that's happening.
If you're a scientist, entomologist, and you're studying particular species, because a lot of entomology gets quite specialist, I'm presuming, and then, you know, that species goes through a really tough time. Not necessarily extinction worldwide, but certainly, you know, locally. How does that affect the people that are studying those species?
I think most people are very pessimistic about the situation at the moment, that despite the fact that we've known a lot of these declines for a long time, it still seems incredibly hard to get society as a whole to do anything to stop it. And it only takes one global emergency, I have to say, like the Ukraine invasion, and suddenly we're talking about coal fire coming back and buying more oil rather than trying to find a way to stop polluting our environment with fossil fuels. So it's to keep positive when you're studying these things, you have to focus upon the positive areas that you can make an impact, to hold on to those and use those and push for those. we still get people asking what are wasps for? Wouldn't the world be better without them? And the fact is, it wouldn't be a better world without wasps. They have a role to play. We live as part of the environment ourselves, and we sometimes forget that we are integral to the natural world. We're all part of the same world, and what we do, accidentally or on purpose, to that environment will come back to bite us.
Listening Station was commissioned as part of Mangotsfield Folly, a project curated by Suzanne Heath in partnership with Artel 31. It's supported by Arts Council England, Emerson's Green Town Council, and Sustrans.